Hello and welcome to Louder Than Words, the pod that's all about ideas that improve lives. I'm Jules Pretty. In this episode, we're talking about public and patient involvement in healthcare systems, how health outcomes improve if systems listen, how the social and medical interact, and how the knowledge and voices of people in their circumstances are rich and powerful. I'm delighted to welcome two guests from the University of Essex's School of Health and Social Care, Tracy Johns and Sally Burrows. Welcome to you both. Let's start with a big question. The UK's NHS and social care system is the largest employer in Europe, with huge public engagement, a common, as it were, that everyone is able to access in theory, but because of other kinds of structural problems, vulnerable and all sorts of other groups, cultural groups, are somehow kind of missing or excluded, and certainly their voices are missing. So if community engagement, I think, Tracy, you've written, is more than involvement, is more than simply reaching out, it's something a little bit more than that. What would you say what we're trying to do? We're not just trying to open up a space for voices. Somehow we've got to do a little bit more than that. Is that right?
Yeah, I think I've been involved in public involvement for a very long time, longer than I wish to admit. And I think now we don't have to justify why we're involving people. I think everyone understands that. And we're very good at what I call the more traditional, systematic involvement, where we invite people to come and join us in our universities, in our healthcare settings, to sit on boards, committees, meetings, and help with the decision making. But of course, that excludes a lot of people that maybe are not able to contribute in that way and who maybe are not interested in contributing that way. And so what the work that we're doing now, and Sally and I are really passionate about this, is we're learning, we're exploring how to do this, but we recognise that what we need to do is to reach out to the people who are underrepresented and find a way of bridging that divide, if you like. How can we help them to have a voice? And at the moment, what we're doing is literally going out into the community, finding those people, finding the people who work and support those people in the charities and the groups within the community who are trusted, and forming relationships with them. Investing.
So that's an interesting word, isn't it? Trust. I was just going to kind of come to that reaching out in this kind of way and hoping to kind of hear from voices, sometimes people might not actually be expecting that. Or indeed, when you arrive as the kind of expert of some sort, whether it's a doctor or a nurse or just somebody from outside the community, somehow you've got to kind of bridge a bit of a gap there between what expectations are and how we actually hear from people about their priorities. So let's hear a little bit about detail then. There's the Reaching Out Project is one of the areas of work. You helped, Tracy, to shape the priorities for the National Institute for Health Research. And the aim is to kind of change and improve people's lives through this public engagement. Tell us a little bit about the Reaching Out Project, because that's got some tangible examples. Perhaps you can talk us through a couple of those kinds of people involved and the sorts of impacts that can be made for them.
Yeah, so the Reaching Out Project is an example of how the NIHR have launched this programme. There are four across the country, and in Essex, ours was working with young people. And the whole aim of it was to try and learn from the local community that you want to work with. And really, really setting aside your agenda, if you like, and listening to them, but also being very flexible and reciprocal, if you like. So if you want examples, what I did was I literally sort of went out, networked. You find that you sort of go to one group and they'll introduce you. Oh, someone, you know, you must go
snowballs onto something else. Yeah. Yes.
So I went to a neighbourhood office in Jaywick that were running a project with young ambassadors in Jaywick. And I was, you know, introduced to Maria, who runs Refugee Action, and then I was introduced to a young art group at First Sight. So very quickly, I sort of gathered this network of groups working with vulnerable young people.
So tell us a bit about that example from Jaywick. People of Essex will know of the deprived community right on the coast, close to Clacton, called Jaywick. And many will have formed prejudices or views before they even think about whether they would even want to go there or not. And yet, if you talk to the people in Jaywick, people are proud of their place. They love the green space behind the houses. They're right on the beach. It's a gorgeous setting. So it's got lots of assets. It just looks run down and deprived. And that perhaps is that something that prevents kind of professional services, in this case we're talking about health and social care, mental health of young people, is that something in the past that's prevented people from approaching places? But as you say, once you're in, something kind of blossoms from that engagement.
And I think that's what happens once you're in with any of these groups, like the refugee community, Jaywick. If you spend the time getting to know people and listening, you quickly realise that actually they have so many assets, they have so many skills, experience, that they have to offer. And actually it was really humbling, because what happened with our project was, I suppose I started off in that traditional way, thinking, oh, we're going to have this partnership group and everyone will have a place on it and we'll meet every so often and that's where we'll do the decision making. And yes, we'll make it creative, we'll do it a bit differently, we'll have food. But actually what happened was I discovered that there was so much that the community could offer, that it was best for us to sort of, if you like, share the power, give them the responsibility, some of the resources, and say to them, will you come up with a plan of how you would like to engage your community in research? And what we ended up with were four really different, very creative projects that were led by the local groups in the community. So one in Jaywick, one in the young art group, one with the refugees, and they were each led by young people from those groups as well.
Fantastic. So could we just hear a little bit more that's tangible about how the priorities of those groups that we're working with, perhaps the Gypsy Traveller, Roma and Showman communities that you've worked with, Sally, what is it that people, what tangible things is it that people are saying we need to know about? But as you say, we would use the term research, but it actually just means finding out stuff in a way that we can act upon it. And you're helping them to find out things. But what are they saying that they need, that would be different? Can we give some tangible examples of, it's this that's really important to us? Perhaps it's one of the groups that you've just mentioned, Tracy, or one of the groups that you've worked with, Sally?
Well, in terms of the Gypsies, Travellers, Showmen, Voters, communication is really important. And I mean, we see in health and social care, the letters come through the post. Well, if you don't have your own address, or if you live on a site and, you know, there are a number of people with the same name, or if you perhaps don't read, immediately you've got a problem. Are people going to get the letter? If they get the letter, are they going to understand it? Is it going to have any meaning? And that is just, a standard mainstream way of communicating, isn't it?
So that's a good example of something that's kind of taken to be completely normal in one part of society, but in another significant part, a more oral culture, people need something different. I can remember talking to an old gypsy couple in middle of Essex. Mm. And I mean, you'll know these examples perfectly well, describing how they navigated across the landscape through signs of pubs, through signs on the roadside, through amendment of trees and bending of branches and all kinds of, not exactly kind of secret language, but a different language, so that people would be able to know things through a different kind of oral culture. But if you're a big institution like the NHS and you're sending out letters to people, well, crikey, this is going to be It's going to fall down a hole, isn't it? Is that what happens?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So what's the solution to that sort of thing? Is it literally more oral stuff, or is it getting people on the ground in those communities to help people?
Yeah, well, I think the solutions need to come from a dialogue, don't they, with people from those communities and the health services. Nobody wants them to miss appointments or to have their health unchecked. So it's really got to be a conversation to find those answers, I think. Going on digital exclusion, you need the device, you need to know how to use the device, you need the data. And you need to know that that's how you access a maternity appointment these days. Yes. And if you don't know and you don't have those things, it's a bad start, isn't it? It's a bad start for a new baby.
The danger is then the system doesn't... it thinks that people are doing it deliberately, perhaps, ignoring letters or just staying... Well, actually, they don't necessarily want to be ignored. They want to get the right kind of healthcare to make sure that the babies have the best start in the world.
Absolutely. They really want to look after their families. And
We've used that one example of kind of... oral versus written language, and certainly different kind of and some different language in that, Roma. But what about working with refugees, Tracy? How is that? Because that's specifically people coming from different, very different cultures with different languages, very vulnerable, having arrived here, perhaps not feeling very welcomed, and then trying to kind of reach out to them. I see that horticulture projects and woodland schools are for young children are good examples of finding ways to give a focus to the engagement, which builds perhaps trust and social capital, and then so other things can happen. Is that the right sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is obviously incredibly complex, but access to health and social care services and more statutory services is the common theme across all of these groups, and particularly with the refugee, the asylum seekers. The group in Colchester, I mean, there's a wonderful Refugee Action Colchester who work with that community and who have built up incredible trust with that community and know in great depth what their needs are and are able to help support them and advocate for them. But there's so many issues around, as you say, it's not just a matter of them not responding to letters, or sometimes it's because they can't. Obviously, there could be a language barrier, but it's much more nuanced than that. It's understanding the stories behind the individuals and what they've been through and why certain situations or certain questions might suddenly, literally send them into trauma or panic. And also even simple things like apparently our being in any buildings in our country is alien. They're just not like the buildings that people are used to living in Syria. So that's why Zach, the young asylum seeker, who was only 16 at the time, who became a real sort of lead person in running our project, he came up with this idea when the challenge was, how can we help involve your community, particularly the young refugees, in having a voice in research? I mean, we didn't use the word research, but how can we have conversations around what matters to them around health and well-being? And so his idea was, well, what I'd like to do is to organise a day in the forest, a forest school. We'll have campfire, we'll have food. And he took it a stage further. He actually set up a little teepee in the forest. I went, it was up in Highwoods in Colchester. And he had a little teepee there where he really wants to be a cameraman and a filmmaker himself. And so we had a professional photographer who let Zach borrow his equipment, and Zach got the young kids to come and sit in the little teepee, and he interviewed them and videoed them talking about what makes you happy, what do you like about being in Colchester, and essentially what he was doing was identifying what priorities potentially for research are. But in the process of that, they were having a wonderful day out. They felt very relaxed, comfortable, the families. it was kind of therapeutic for them at the same time. And so there's such a contrast between that and the way that then health services are expecting these people to engage with them. So that's why I would suggest they really need to work with the organisations like Refugee Action.
So it's finding the right organisation to work with people. It's finding the right kind of voice and the listening context. But then it's finding the right context to bring people together, taking them into the woods, doing something in particular in a non-threatening environment, taking them out of the buildings that might make people uncomfortable or worried about. If we think of the state of many buildings in Syria, it's no wonder you'd be worried if you're inside. It's unsafe for many people for a long period of time. And going to the forest, completely different. So perhaps that opens up something different. Let's slide away now and hear a bit from Peter Beresford, Emeritus Professor of Citizen Participation at the University of Essex. Peter, you've spent a lot of your whole and distinguished career about participatory social welfare, engaging many voices. You have a long experience of these things. Why does this matter so much in our health and social care systems?
Oh, I think it matters in those systems and much more generally, because there's never been such a contentious time, at least in my memory, which is quite long, where opinions have been so polarized. And I think there is a real desire amongst many people, and I'm sure amongst policymakers too, to see a kind of a change which is much more towards participatory approaches, towards public policy and governance. But what I think we really have got to do is recognise in context of health and social care two things. One, that the current gospel, and I think it's a good one, is that all of us need to take much more personal responsibility for our health and well-being. And that has to be right. We're at different places in being able to do that, both because of economic and social factors, but also because of our opportunities to understand our own health. The second bit that's talked about less often and is much more directly, it would seem, I think, in the context of our participation discussion, is people need, if that's going to happen, to have much more say and control in health systems and structures of service. I have to tell you that I talk to welfare rights officers working in the community now, who will speak to patients and service users who, one, don't know what's wrong with them when they're trying to sort out their benefits to get help, and two, don't even know what the medication is that they are judiciously taking. People are often at a very low position. So there's a whole process, I think, needed here of what I would call empowerment, to enable us all really to be able to participate, to be the active citizens, both looking after their own health and also taking a much more active role in services and policies. And then that has to connect with the broader matter of recognizing that you have a real right and a potential to make change in systems, in society, as some of us have been happy and lucky enough to find out. And that's where we can engage on much more equal terms with policymakers and politicians. And that then could be the place where it's not just so much about people knocking on the door and trying to get a bit of a say, but where we can move to what I think is the ideal process, because it includes every perspective, every group of people, takes account of issues of ethnicity, of gender, of sexuality, of age, and all the rest of those things that can be treated as barriers rather than our full diversity, for all of us to, our whole picture, to inform the health system and the individual healthcare that we really need.
So we're in that kind of vision for a more participatory and democratic health system. I think you've written that participation therefore should be a right in all of these things, and I think we would all be nodding about that. What would we see as improvement? How would you describe improvement in a system that's less market-led and determined, that might be a challenge to some existing structures, but we would hope to be beneficial? But what would be how would you describe that term improvement? What would be in your mind?
I think at every level, and I would stress that people may have particular reservations about the market, but I think also charitable organisations and state organisations have equally not necessarily been good at opening the doors and letting us all in and listening to, in a serious way, listening to what we have to say. It's step by step. The interesting thing is, of course, a legal right. We actually do have a legal right in some areas of health and care to have an effective say, but sadly, those legal rights are not very well expressed and strengthened and made possible. We don't necessarily have legal aid to enforce them. And so it can be a bit of a situation where if something does go wrong, it's going to feel like there's bigger problem taking action to rectify it as the original problem. That atmosphere has to change. I have to say, if problems may start at the top, I think solutions start at the bottom. I have to say really here that I think practice, the way that ordinary practitioners work, and I'm not saying it's all sorted, has it changed dramatically over the last few years. We're operating a system now where, for example, in a number of allied health professions, as well as in social work, service users and carers are directly involved in offering and shaping that training and education. And some of the people going on it are now being valued and recognized for having the life experience on the other side of the counter, as it were. It's I think, about rethinking ourselves primarily. We're not a group of vulnerable and invulnerable people, professionals and service users, not really. What we are is a population of human beings who need to learn better within systems how to relate equally and inclusively to each other. The will is there. We're needing policymakers to catch up.
So that's quite a significant change that's almost been happening. It's not in secret when it comes to those of you around the table here who understand health and social care systems. But it's kind of crept up a little bit. If you're seeing those kinds of fundamental changes in relationships, people are seeing others in different kinds of ways from both sides of the counter, as you say, that suggests some kind of a sense of confidence for going forward from here, particularly in the light of the last 2 years of the pandemic, which has challenged and changed almost everything.
I think you're right. I think there's a lot of catching up needed to be done. I think our personal politics, and I've seen that, we've all seen that in the way that issues of discrimination, if not necessarily adequately addressed and challenged, are recognised, and you will be held to account increasingly if you're discriminatory. But I don't think our formal politics have caught up with that yet. I think our services and policies are improving. But this may have crept up quietly, but let's remember the first provisions for public participation in the UK were made in the late 1960s, which is hardly recent. I think the trouble is that we need to reflect this kind of inclusive participation, not just at a grassroots level, but also in the way our formal politics work. And we know that they are very unequal, very excluding, even around such basic issues as gender and ethnicity. Still, that has to be tackled. We are seeing it being tackled in business. We're seeing it being tackled in the voluntary sector. I don't think we've any right to have lesser expectations of our politicians and policymakers. So I think you're right, it's been creeping, but for a very long time. And I think, unfortunately, progress is more one step forward and two steps back sometimes. And we really need to concentrate our minds, because the brutal truth is, and we always know this, when anything goes wrong for anybody, if they can, what they do is try and get involved to change it. It could be about what's happening to their child at school. It could be about some health issue that we've been talking about. It could be even about something quite simple like the way the drains work locally. People, even if they've never done it before, rise to the challenge and want to have an involvement. There are still too many barriers of all kinds in the way of that, but the culture will change. It is changing. And I always feel that those of us who argue this point do have the angels on our side.
Thank you very much indeed, Peter. That's a fantastic vision for engagement actually being about transformation, about changing lives for the better. And that's what we've been talking about. Thank you. Okay, so we've heard a bit about the importance of public engagement within these tremendous big health and social care systems that we have in the UK, within which we all have the rights to be treated in all sorts of ways that are important to us, and yet there are various structures that prevent people's engagement. So we've been hearing about how important it is to literally reach out to people and establish new forms of relationship and new kinds of trust. Could we just pick up on a little bit more on some of those details as to how those things tangibly affect people's lives? So it's not just we're doing this partly, I assume, because the engagement itself can change people's lives. It can make them feel more important, more kind of welcomed. But we would hope it would improve their health and longevity in due course as well, and their life opportunities, as we were hearing before the break about Zach, the young Syrian, hoping to become a cameraman and a documentary maker and so forth. Sally, what sorts of thoughts have you got around that?
I'm just thinking, as you talk about the importance of being heard and how, you know, inviting people to an office or a meeting room to discuss things really just doesn't work for everyone. And, you know, previously, I think when people have worked with gypsies and travellers and travelling communities generally, they've gone to where they live and, you know, had face-to-face contact and been able to gain trust and understanding through that personal meeting, which hasn't, of course, been possible during lockdown. So we've had to reach out in different ways, really. And you know, it wasn't obvious to me how we would do that in the first instance. So speaking to people who kind of bridge the two worlds is really helpful. And
how does that kind of bridging then lead to short-term changes that people feel are improvements in their lives? I mean, this can be for the professionals. I'd be quite interested to hear your observations about does this sort of thing change how it is to work as a nurse or a care professional, but it's also how this is actually changing people's lives in their circumstances. What sort of examples are there of how people would notice that as a result of this different process?
Well, things like being open to communication through a text message or WhatsApp or using Facebook, familiar mediums that people are comfortable with.
And do you find that then also might make them take up a service at a particular time that would be important to them? Let's think of the example of young mothers, for example, with young children. If you are kind of vulnerable in a deprived community, separated a bit from services, there will be expectations from services that you'll be toddling along at just the right time to get the checks. But if you're sitting outside the system, you may just miss all of that altogether. What about people then? What about, I think there's one project of helping nurses in care homes. Do professionals' lives themselves, can they be improved? In other words, when you're thinking about building these new relationships and new forms of trust that lead to different outcomes. It's not just, as it were, the people in the communities. It's the people in the healthcare system as well that we would hope would, A, recognise that that's helpful, but also, oh, that's changing my life a little bit.
I mean, in the project I was running with reaching out, for example, when I had that kind of eureka moment, it was when I visited the Young Art Group. And I was, to be honest, feeling a bit overwhelmed, thinking, how on earth is this project all going to come together and how? And it was actually one of the young people who came up with this amazingly creative idea of, I know how I want to talk to young people. We'll do it with, you know, she created this this visual way of sort of getting young people to draw how they felt and use emojis and, you know. And it was so creative. And I suddenly thought, oh, well, she could use that as her medium and her, you know, she could work with her community. And then maybe we could get the other groups to come up with their own ideas. So to get back to the benefits for me as a project lead, if you like, were that I ended up with four times as much data, if you like, or...
Useful information.
Information, yeah. Which was really useful. But also it was really... The project gained quite a lot of recognition. Actually, it was the young people that did all the work.
That's brilliant. That's fantastic.
But I was able to enjoy.
So I think that what you've described there is a really lovely way of saying that the professionals coming into circumstances where you are opening yourself up to other voices is a little bit vulnerable because your own expertise, the time that we've spent learning stuff and the way to do things, you're setting that to one side and saying to people, okay, let's hear what you have to say. And they might say anything. It might be helpful. It might not be helpful. It might be friendly. It might be unfriendly. But in that sense, what we'd be saying is, well, whatever they say is going to be important. So let's start with that and then see what we can build from it. Is that what we're hearing from that kind of arts project, where you turn it around and let young people, in this particular example, lead?
Yeah.
And more will come from it, which gives us more priorities to develop research later on.
Yeah, I think we get so much more out of it because it's more honest. It enable and they're more open. But also, I mean, just that went one stage further in that we then actually held a big event here at the university in our new science STEM centre. And it was on a Saturday. And this was towards the end of the project where we thought, well, we'll bring the community into the university now because they've got to know us. And actually, they wanted to. They were intrigued. But we held it on a Saturday. And this was more for the community partners we organised. We got the creche involved. We had a creche. We had a child entertainer. And we said, bring your kids. It was about young people anyway. But what happened was some of the academics who wanted to come along had issues, the same issues with childcare. So we said, well, you bring your kids too. And what we ended up with was a real level playing field. Everyone there on the same, with, you know, all mums, all dads bringing their kids. The kids actually got involved because we didn't put them in a separate room. So we benefited because we got even younger voices to talk about priorities.
This is very interesting. So what we end up doing is finding out about the rich texture of people's lives rather than them just being a patient, as it were.
Yeah.
So, an individual with a particular characteristic. It might be a name of a community. It might be male or female, or it might be old or young. But actually, you find out this kind of hinterland that we each all have, which, of course, determines a lot of health outcomes, if you understand that well. Well, these ideas about reforms, if we can put it that way, to national health and social care systems can't change structural complexity. They can't change inequality in systems, resourcing decisions by government, not in the short term, certainly. They can't change how to find and support staff, but they can help to build a more inclusive society, as we've been hearing about, greater trust, better health outcomes. What would each of you say then as your kind of top one or two priorities? Here we find ourselves 2 years on from the beginnings of the pandemic that's changed the world, certainly changed people's views of healthcare. What would you say your kind of priorities are at this particular stage? One or two. Sally?
Improving understanding, really, between different parts of society. So, you know, we've talked a lot about trust and the importance of trust. Well, a lot of trust or a lot of fear is from people's experiences, whether they're personal experiences of being turned away or treated a certain way, or, you know, having their children taken away and not understanding why, for example. And similarly, you know, there've been nurses and midwives who've been and emergency services who've been frightened to go to travellers' sites, for example, because they've heard bad things. But really, when you break it down and talk to people about their actual experiences, well, maybe maybe nobody at the health service has actually had a bad encounter on a traveller's site. It's just hearsay. And you know, maybe when you talk about individual experiences with health workers on the ground, maybe they did care for you and treat you as a person beyond, you know, beyond your label. So breaking that down, those assumptions, I think goes a long way to the solutions.
Perfect. Tracy?
I think I would say that I would like to see much more collaboration with the grassroots organisations in the third sector, the non-profit making sector, that really know the vulnerable communities that they work with, and much more opportunities for services to be commissioned through those organisations, because I think that will help improve access, because people, services will be more bespoke to the particular communities. And I think we all, it's about equality as well. You know, why should just people who are confident and know how to speak the language of the NHS or social care, why are they the only people that should be able to be part of the decision making? I really believe that we will all benefit if somehow we find a way for everyone to have a voice. And the other thing that I feel passionate about as well is that when we do this sort of work, particularly, you know, the work that we're doing, which is funded through the NHS or the National Institute of Health Research, is that we're very conscious about how we're going to sustain the relationships that we're building. One, because actually what we've said is it takes a long time to build up those relationships. And so we don't want to waste all that investment and all, you know, the resources that we've used to develop those relationships, but also because we can benefit even more. Because what I've found with the work that I've done, and I think, Sally, you found the same, is that there's so many kind of unintended, unexpected,
huge benefits
that come out. You know, one thing leads to another. And we've got this ripple effect of... And it's about working as an ecosystem and everybody working cross disciplines together as much as possible, because then you can open up opportunities. So, for example, Molly, the young woman who got involved in our project, she has now got the confidence to contribute to a couple of national charities which relate to her conditions. She's helping with research. She's sitting here in the university on the School for Health and Social Care, contributing to training health, nurses of the future. That never would have happened.
And it all came from that engagement. That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, great. Thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure to talk to Tracy Johns and Sally Burrows from the School of Health and Social Care here at the University of Essex. We've heard about this kind of thinking about the wider system, and we've heard about different institutions, voluntary, charitable, third sector organisations that can help statutory ones. And we've heard a little bit about different ways of working that perhaps at the core of them have a greater friendliness and the belonging that brings people together, which in the end will hopefully create better outcomes for all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Louder Than Words. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast. Have a look at the website for more information, and do rate the pod if you can.